have four more. We have the Secretary of State's bill, which we've heard. Paul, we heard one other SJR on the double majority. And we have four more bills that are all relatively similar. And this is part of the school capital conversation that we've been having for a few days now. Open up the hearing on SJR 27, SJR 35, SJR 37, and SJR 38. Paul Warner, the Washington Cougars' biggest fan, State Cougars, still in mourning.
The season is over, Mr. Chair.
Barely.
Mr. Chair, what I've done is just put together a table for you to look at the measures that are before you, and they are similar, as you say. A couple of them are, in fact, the exact same wording. On the table, I have SJR 10 and SB 80, which you've heard, SB 80 being the implementing language. That was a Secretary of State's bill, which repeals the section of the Constitution that refers to the double majority, and that section is actually on the back of your sheet. It's section 11, sub 8, there, in which an election requires at least 50% of registered voters eligible to vote in the election cast a ballot, or the election is in a general election in an even numbered year. So that's about a third of the way down the page of the first column, section 8. So that's what these measures do. SJR 35 also has SB 921, which is implementing language, basically repealing reference to the double majority in statute. That's sponsored by Senator Avakian. SJR 37 and 38 also repeal that section. All of them have an effective date of 6/19/08, and they're all referred to the next primary election, which would be May of 08. Senator Walker and Senator Westland have sponsored those. SJR 27 does not repeal the double majority requirement, but rather it changes it. And if you look at SJR 27, you can see that first of all, it says that the voter participation requirements do not apply to elections held after June 19, 2008. And then the next sub 2 says that a local taxing district may submit a property tax measure only at a general election, as in current law, or at a special election held in May of any year. So it adds the May primary ballot makes that exempt from the double majority requirements. And that's sponsored by Senator Devlin and Representative Hunt.
Great. Questions for Paul. So I think Representative Hunt and Senator Devlin have been active on this issue for quite some time, and I know pushed a bill last session that made it through partway, and have certainly been the leaders in this building on this issue. And I'm going to open a hearing on 921 and turn it over to Representative Hunt and Senator Devlin. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 921 also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I want to thank you for this opportunity in hearing SJR 27 and I believe SJR 35. Representative Hunt and I have actually, this is our third session working together on this issue. We managed to make it through one chamber last session, but not both chambers. We think we have a good chance of actually making it through both chambers this session. The intent of SJR 27 is to replace the double majority, not to repeal it. That may seem to some to be a distinction without a difference, but it is not. In 1996, voters passed Measure 47. An obscure provision in Measure 47 required property tax measures to meet two standards. First, the measure must pass by a majority of voters casting ballots, and second, at least 50% of eligible voters must cast a ballot. The general exemption was exempted from this requirement. Thus, the double majority requirement was added to the Constitution. The justification for this in 1996 for a double majority was that measures were being intentionally referred to low turnout elections where governments could simply rally their supporters to pass whatever measure they put on the ballot. Due to the constitutional crisis that occurred at that time, with Measure 47, which the legislature worked that entire session to replace with Measure 50, the legislature felt that it had to mimic Measure 47 and thus kept the double majority in that measure. It's little known fact, sometimes people forget elections, that we also referred to the 1998 May ballot a repeal of the double majority. That failed by the narrowest of margins, 51-49%. A lot has changed since 1998. Vote by mail has changed elections. Referral to obscure elections are no longer possible. We then had 8 elections per year. We now have 4. All voters now receive a ballot in the mail, so there's really no surprise that an election has occurred. Turnout has improved dramatically by vote by mail. Conversion also to a rate-based versus a tax-based levy property tax system has led to far fewer property tax elections. Why this proposal? Well, I think Representative Hunt is in agreement that we need to approach this as a replacement rather than a repeal, and with some good reasons. Our measures only differ slightly, and we're co-chief sponsors of both measures. Mine allows for 3 elections every 2 years. The one I started, the one Representative Hunt started, is 4 elections every 2 years. What's wrong with the double majority? I think it tries to address a measure, a problem that no longer exists. There will be some that will give you, and I think Representative Hunt will be one of those, that will give you a lot of details about measures that have went to the ballot that have had overwhelming support but fell just short of actually having the double majority. I'm going to just refer to one just recently because I think it's a good example. In the city of West Lynn, they had a police levy on the March ballot. People worked in the community night and day to convince the public to pass the measure. It received 72% of the popular vote, and 28% voted no. And it fell short of the double majority because there was a 45% turnout. If 720 people, additional people at 721, had went to the poll and had voted no, it would have still passed by 65%-35%. Obviously, the people in West Lynn overwhelmingly favored maintaining 40% of the funding for their city police, and probably, hopefully, will vote it in sometime in the future, but who knows when they'll be able to meet the current double majority. One of the reasons why, though, I'm actually opposed to the double majority goes far deeper than the issue of measures passing and failing. To be perfectly honest, if measures were just failing because people didn't favor them, I wouldn't have an issue here today, because I believe strongly in our electoral process. The problem I have is the way the double majority is constructed. It gives more weight to non-participants than to participants. I think all of us that are in electoral politics have a strong belief in our electoral system. Many of us realize that the rights that some people take for granted haven't been with us for that long, and for many Americans and many Oregonians, they haven't been with us that long at all. In the last 100 years, the right of women to vote became universal in 1920. Persons of color were systematically prevented from exercising their right to vote until the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. And young men and women were sent off to war during a period of time many of us lived through who did not have the right to vote. And we finally extended the right to vote to those 18 years and older in 1971. So it has not been that long of a time. This is my fundamental reason. There would be no reason that I would think would be greater, that I think this is just contrary to a representative democracy, contrary to a participatory democracy. I've in previous occasions, and I don't think I'll avoid it again here because I like the quote so much, I'll probably just do it again. President Abraham Lincoln, in his Gettysburg Address on November 19, 1863, probably the most memorable statements ever made by a chief executive, we here highly resolve that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that the government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. Of the people, by the people, and for the people. Clearly, Lincoln believed that our freedoms come with responsibilities. If voters can't bother to turn in a ballot either 3 times every 2 years or 4 times every 2 years, then we have much deeper problems in this representative democracy. I think if Abraham Lincoln were here today, he would tell you that a double majority has no place in any state's constitution.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. It has been a pleasure to work with Senator Devlin and Senator Morse and others over the last two sessions, this being the third, to finally reform the really disastrous double majority election requirement. As Chair Deckard stated at the beginning, this is a core issue as we're looking at how to help local school districts with capital construction needs. There's no question that this has got to be one piece of the tool that really enables them to send out to voters a bond measure and allow voters to vote those up or down without having to allow non-voters to veto those measures. So although I think it is a key assistance piece for capital construction, it also is a key change that needs to be made, because the measures that have been killed over the last 10 years have been not just school measures, but have been wastewater measures and fire and police and veteran services. They've been community colleges and K-12. They've been road measures, libraries, parks, a whole variety of measures across the state, where a majority of voters, 51, 60, 70, 80%, have said, yes, we want to pass this measure. And yet, because non-voters have chosen to stay at home, in some cases intentionally to veto the will of voters, those measures have failed. So I think it's critical to do it. As Senator Devlin said, the Senate did its job 2 years ago, and the House is ready to step up to the challenge this year. Whether that vehicle be SGR 27, as Senator Devlin outlined, or HGR 14, the very similar House version, we are ready to step up this session and join you in partnership to move double majority reform to the voters. We did testify several weeks ago on one of the measures, and you have other measures before you today that would be a full repeal of the double majority. I personally would support that measure. I think we've got a much easier sell to voters to say we want to reform this measure. The core principle of the double majority would be left in place. There would not be the opportunity to have all these random elections all throughout the year, as was once true. But in any May and November elections, there would at least be the opportunity to have a very novel principle in a democracy that the majority wins. Since we're quoting Republicans today, Senator Devlin quoted President Lincoln. I'll quote a much more contemporary Republican, former Republican Party Chair Kevin Mannix, the gubernatorial nominee in, what year was that, 2002?
A couple of times.
Kevin Mannix said, "I think we need to revisit the double majority requirement. With vote by mail, there are no more sneak elections, and the double majority isn't needed," unquote. I think Kevin Mannix has it right. We had, perhaps when the double majority was first included as a very overlooked provision of Measure 47, perhaps there was some validity to it. With all the elections that Senator Devlin mentioned, and with what I think some local governments had done in trying to do sneak elections occasionally prior to vote by mail. That's no longer possible, and we've now lived through and seen the devastating effects that the double majority election requirement has had. It's time to give voters a chance to reform it, and I think we've got a couple of good vehicles to do that. Appreciate your support.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, been thinking about this a lot. Of course, I've been involved in government all my life, and I support the four-election proposal that you put forward. I think people are used to voting in May, and they're used to voting in November. And to simply say that those elections are exempt from the double majority, I think makes sense. So that's the direction I would like to go.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. I have a bill on the docket today that the hearing, public hearing's not open on it, but I just won't need to speak to that because...
Senator, would you identify yourself?
Oh, yeah. That's, you know, that's so
we're
bad.
Sick, we
it's
forget.
So bad, especially when I'm a committee chair and I ask people to do that. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7 from Eugene, where I came up from this morning. It is my dog's first birthday today. So in honor of my dog, I'm wearing a pin. And he got a birthday cake this morning, but it wouldn't be one that you would want to eat. Anyway, back to the matters at hand. I support just outright repeal of the darn thing, but I'm willing to take anything I can get. These gentlemen have worked very hard on some compromise language. I can tell you two examples right now. I mean, Bethel School District in my Senate district put a measure on the ballot in May. They had enough votes to pass the darn thing, but they didn't have the double majority requirement met, so they lost. They put the bond measure back on the ballot in November, and then they lost. Here in your Capitol Clips, just yesterday, is the headline from the Venn Bulletin from the 16th of March, double majority strikes again. And that was the Lapine Fire District. They had way more than they needed to support the measure, but they didn't meet the double majority requirement. You see these stories every day. Senator Devlin just told you about West Lynn. I mean, they're all over the place. And it's so frustrating. And, you know, I think we could win at the ballot, but I'll take the compromise here because it was a close election once before when we referred it to the voters. I think that my two colleagues have laid the case out very well. I love it when they cite history and historical figures who've made some really important points over the years. And, you know, it's time to get it done and make it right and have government work the way that we expect it to, which is an elective democracy. And if people want to stay home and not vote, well, that's their choice, but it should not impact our ability to get our work done. So that's where I'm at, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
And we have opened your bill up.
Oh, you did?
Opened them all up.
All right.
So you're on your bill and anyone else's.
SJR 37. So if you want to go to the ballot and repeal, we can do it any number of ways. But we just have to do something. And if we don't do it this session, then we are not getting the job done.
Strong testimony.
I agree.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We'll follow your guys' lead on how to word the resolution. Senator Ben Westlund.
Happy birthday.
Cool. It's our dog's birthday.
Muffy.
Toby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westlund, District 27, here to testify on behalf of one, all, any of the bills you had before you. Obviously, I'm chief sponsor of one, and I have no specific pride of authorship in a particular methodology to eliminate the double majority, although to share Senator Monroe's sentiments, I believe probably the four-election scenario is the most workable. And, you know, that's kind of a little bit of a technical side of the thing, but really this is much more fundamental than when the elections are held or how many. I mean, the very definition of democracy is participation. And as stewards of the public process, we should do everything within our powers to encourage participation. It is most fundamental, and that is why the double majority needs to go the way of the dinosaur. You've heard many of the examples, you know, fire districts, police levies, school levies, construction bonds, sewer, water, fire. These are really the infrastructure of our state that is most impacted by the double majority. you know, specific example, most recently in my district, I mean, you heard about the Lapine Fire District, but there were two counties in the state that were slipped through the cracks in the original crafting of ballot measure 50. One was Linn County, the other was Deschutes County. And it was pretty amazing. I mean, I understand how, quote, we as crafters made the mistake in the legislature of the 2,800 taxing districts in this state. Ballot measure 50 pretty well addressed most of them, except those that had a levy expiring and was reapproved at the same millage amount on the day ballot measure 50 passed. Of those 2,800 districts, 17 slipped through that crack, and some of them were things like the Vail Park and Rec District, fairly small districts. Two significant ones were the Linn County Sheriff's Department and Deschutes County Sheriff's Department. So we got no permanent funding. Since that time, the sheriffs in Deschutes County have had to go every 2 years, usually in May, for operating levies. Needless to say, they have failed. In our last one, in May, the yes vote was 66.53% to 33.47%. This with 41% turnout. That's actually a pretty high turnout for a primary. But obviously, that election was held invalid because of the double majority. I would suggest that most of the elected officials in this room would, not have been elected. I mean, we're sitting here, you know, under the double majority requirements, you know, as invalid office holders.
Mr. Chair, a little bit of this is... I think the senator hit on something there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Required double majority for all of us.
Yeah. You know, the incessant election, the never-ending election. I think the real point here is that the cost, both in terms of financial to the county, holding these elections is expensive. I mean, needless to say, it went back on the November ballot and, you know, passed pretty handily. But the cost, both in terms to the county, but more importantly to the fabric of democracy in our communities, is significant. Some of your previous testifiers indicated the work and the effort and the fervor and the vigor that people put in to trying to improve their communities, whether it be the fire bond or the sheriffs or the school construction or, you know, even the sewer levy. And to have their efforts succeed only to fail on the technicality of the double majority, I think erodes confidence in the public process. So there's much we can do in this area to help restore what I think is one of our most important functions in government, and that is confidence in the democratic process. Mr. Chair, I appreciate you hearing these bills, inviting me to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Testimony. Questions? Thank you. Didn't think it was possible to bring new information to this issue, and a couple of them, including some of us might not be double majority proof up here. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Have to go back and check.
Yeah, I checked you. You look star. You know.
We're safe.
Yeah.
Washington County. Kepi Eaton, the League of Women Voters. Marcia Kelly. Association of American University Women, and Ralph Groner, the inimitable Ralph Groner. A power-packed panel here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kappy Eaton. I'm the governor's coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. As you know, the League, as our name implies, is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed participation in government. I am here to support the elimination of the double majority. It's a terrible feeling when you work hard for a levy, for instance, and it fails. Not because you didn't work hard, but because more people voted against it than voted for it. But it's an even worse feeling when you work very hard and you pass it, only it fails because not enough people came out to vote. The League feels very strongly that this allows the decision to be made by non-participants. They've taken a decision away from you. And that's why we strongly support your action to allow the citizens to take this back and think about it, because we have removed the majority idea from our form of government when a majority doesn't win the election. When I was in Bosnia supervising their elections in 2000, that election was held after our presidential election, and so we were sort of glued to the television watching what was happening in the United States. And I walked in a little bit late and I said, well, who's won? And they said, nobody knows. They know who got enough votes, but it isn't, that's not counting. Why is that? Why did you not have a majority? So it was a feeling, I had no answer for them. It's not exactly the same issue, but it's the idea that you expect our form of government to move ahead when more people vote for something than vote against it. So I'm just here to urge you to move this some action forward to bring this about. And if you refer it to the ballot, the League certainly will be working very hard to get it passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Eaton. Question, Senator George.
There is, a question that was raised earlier when we heard the bills about the idea that we can't operate here other than special circumstances just to take testimony as an informational hearing without a quorum. And the idea that 25 or so percent of the people would show up to vote. But there's a way to solve that problem, and I proposed this years ago, and that is particularly today with vote by mail. You have a ballot that when you hand it in, they know who you are, okay? And we separate those pieces when it goes in, and it's then the secret ballot. But there's also the provision on there to record a tax vote, and here's what would happen. If you voted yes for the tax vote, your taxes would go up. If you voted no, yours would not. What is your reaction to that?
Well, Senator Deckett, Senator George, I happen to believe that as a member of a republic, representative republic, that I pay taxes to provide for the common good. And so I don't have any problem with voting yes on taxes. That's the only thing I can say to you.
Thanks.
Provocative, interesting idea.
You're a rascal.
He says rascal.
He's a rascal.
Ms. Kelly.
Chair Deckard and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and Brownie points to Senator Deckard for knowing that AUW is the American Association of University Women of Oregon, and I'm on their public policy committee. AUW has 2,000 members around the state, from Ontario to Astoria, from Ashland up to Portland, and all points in between, including a branch in Wallowa County. We are in support of any type of repeal. I would prefer just a straight repeal. And I will try to touch on a couple of things that have not been touched upon this morning. When special districts, counties, school districts go out in May and do not get a double majority and then have to go in November, those taxes cannot be assessed, and the property owners do not pay those taxes for a complete another year from that November date. So there is a disconnect with the voters. There's also a lag time for often very needed services. And so in the instance of not knowing what's happening, cutbacks happen. Then if you're lucky in November, you get to put back the services. And that is a disservice to the functioning of government. Taxes are one of the things that we pay as a cost to having a democracy. And to allow people who choose not to return their ballots or who do not care about returning their ballots to then have an additional say in how government is going to operate for the good of all is, I believe, neither fair nor possibly constitutional. We've all heard the examples. Transit districts are part of those people who sometimes lose. We've heard the examples. We know the issue. AUW will, again, like the League of Women Voters, get our members to educate the voters. And that's what a lot of us are about, because our membership is composed of men and women with associate or higher academic degrees. And I would be happy to entertain any questions, and thank you for letting us testify.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I probably need to clarify my position. I hate the double majority. I think it's anti-democratic. I would like to see it completely repealed. I just feel like modifying it to go to a four-vote system where every May and every November taxing districts could ask for a vote and not have to worry about the double majority. I think that would have a much better chance of being approved by the voters than an outright repeal, and that's why that's my position.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator.
Yes, Senator Starr.
Thank you. One part of your testimony intrigued me. You mentioned that you believe this double majority may be unconstitutional.
It allows someone who doesn't cast their ballot to have a double effect. First, they don't vote so that they don't have a choice, and then they don't vote, and that creates a position where you'd have to have either a no vote or a yes vote voting in order to get a measure passed.
So, Mr. just to follow up, this measure, the double majority, is in the Oregon Constitution.
But it's...
So you're saying it would violates the federal constitution? And if so, there's a lot of advocates that are here, you know, all over Oregon that advocate for more taxes that have deep pockets that could have challenged this on constitutional grounds, and yet I don't think that's happened.
I don't think it has either, but some of us don't have deep pockets who actually believe that.
There's a lot of folks, some organizations sitting in the room that do, so... Just an observation, Mr. Chair, I guess.
Someone with very deep pockets. Ralph the Groaner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is I smile when I come in front of this group. That's all. That's a compliment. For the my name.
Yeah, well,
that's a compliment. My name is Ralph Groaner, representing AFSCME, and I'll only ditto what my Clackamas County Senator from my county, Senator Devlin, and of course Representative Hunt from right near where I live, have recommended two very wonderful proposals. We would ask me, since our cities are our members, and the county they live in are our members, most of the cities are our members, and if you go to Multnomah, it's wall-to-wall ask me. We really have a heavy responsibility in local government and levies, from libraries to highways, everything but schools. And I have watched carefully. I'll shorten mine to say just ditto. I thought they gave my representation from my county did a wonderful job. So I'll focus only on one component that no one has, and it's my union's priority, one of. And that's economic development. So let me tie the double majority. My county, for example, Clackamas County, my local I belong to, local 350, Clackamas County Public Works, roads, highways. Compared to Washington County, your county, Mr. Chair, and then let's compare that to Multnomah County, Senator Monroe, and let's compare the double majority in terms of our transportation system as it relates to the double majority and economic development. currently, if you read the statistics on congestion for the metro area, you'll see we face a major crisis within 20 years as it deals with companies even wanting to stay on our highway because they can't get their product. They can't get their product to market. Clackamas got Washington County's county was forward enough to approve additional money for highways. Multnomah County approved money for highways. Clackamas County went out to vote probably, if I recall, 10 times over the last decade on highway funds. And the fact of the matter is we would receive the majority, but then we got caught up in the latter years with the double majority, so we have this schism between in the tri-county. Our members, 70% of them, work out of county. They go over to Selwood Bridge, they cause the problem. But we can't get our highway fixed in our county to the tune where Fred Meyer says, you don't fix it, we can't get our trucks to the highway 205 from where we're at just a few miles away. We, quote, will be looking at moving elsewhere, and it may not be even in our region. I could quote you others. My only comment about the double majority is it currently works. It's adversely affecting people working, getting to work, and providing income tax dollars from their work to come into this general fund that funds schools, universities, human resources, and public safety. So I would hope you would consider that, and my county's the ultimate example of where the double majority has really hindered highway development, which hinders economic development. Thank you.
Good point. Thank you. Good point on highway. Never thought of that. Last two. And then we'll move on to 366. Rick Levine. Levine?
Levine.
And Gail Riddell.
Chair Decker, members of the committee, my name is Rick Levine. I'm representing the Oregon Community College Association, and I'm here to basically support all of the bills on the double majority. Over the last 2 days, I know that you heard from many community college presidents regarding the projects that were in front of you that are hopefully going to be funded by this legislature, and the issue on going ahead and getting public support for the match money. You have my testimony, and I'm not going to go over it. I just want to share a couple of things with you that are in the testimony that are that concern college presidents when we go out to for an election. When I was president at Rogue Community College, we ran three elections. When I was vice president at Schmeckler Community College, we ran two elections. All of those were after the double majority was passed. At Rogue Community College, the first election was defeated under the double majority. That election cost us about $45,000 in college money, and I raised personally $125,000 in the community for that election. The next two elections, again, cost almost an identical amount of money. The third election finally passed the bond levy to achieve the match money we needed from to match the state dollars. The issue for us in the very first election was rather unique. We had a bank of citizens calling taxpayers, calling people who are on the roll that were going to be voting. We found that 1 in 10 out of 10,000 people that were called, 1 in 10 had either moved or were deceased. And yet, as part of the double majority, their actual non-vote was counted. If we had those records cleaned up, we would have passed into the double majority. The problem with the double majority is, in fact, the county clerks have not cleaned the rolls out to make sure that you're actually counting the right people when you calculate the double majority. I mentioned in my testimony in front of you what happened to Portland Community College. And just one issue before I close for both colleges. What occurs is that the taxpayer in Oregon really wants you to persevere. Actually the Medford Mail Tribune talks about it. If you go three times in Jackson County, you'll pass a bond levy. And maybe it's because that the people wanted to hear from you as to how you're going to spend the money. Maybe they wanted to see the bond levy pared down. But it's a persistence issue. Well, what happens to you is that your construction costs escalate, because we're not talking about going for two or three elections in 1 year. Usually you go maybe once a year for 3 years. I'm just using that as an example. By the time you wind up with your project, you're 4, maybe 5 years out from when you initially designed the project, and it now has probably cost you 20 to 25% more. Most of these are public funds, taxpayer funds. So it's a huge expense to the citizens of Oregon just to try to continue this whole process under the double majority. As I said, you have my testimony, and I'd be very glad to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're up against the clock. Gail, thank you for...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties Policy Manager. On January 17th, we made our first presentation about the financial crisis in Oregon as a result of the expiration of the Federal Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act of 2000. And it's $200 million a year to county government. It's a joint challenge because you've seen this ubiquitous chart. We share service responsibilities with you. The crisis plays out differently depending on the county because of our complex finance system. And I must add that any congressional action on this will merely buy us time, buy us some breathing room to explore state and local solutions. We appreciate very much what's beginning to happen in Congress, but we understand what it is. It's not going to continue forever. On March 12th, county commissioners and judges voted unanimously to request that the legislature help remove two constitutionally structural handcuffs that have prevented, could prevent counties from helping themselves. The first, which is not subject to discussion today, is to permit a county government to seek voter approval to change its permanent property tax rate. And you may recall that we have counties that are at or below $1 a thousand in permanent property tax rates. Our second request, which is being discussed today, is to establish a majority vote requirement for local levies. Now, we agree with Senator Monroe that the appropriate measure would be 4 elections in 2 years, on May and November. This is targeted to those elections which voters most commonly participate and where there is no element of surprise. We ask this as a means for us to help ourselves and help continue our participation in the state-county shared service system.
Very succinct and to the point. Thank you very much, Gail. And impressive efforts back in Washington, D.C. I know you guys have had a full court press on the rural county issue, and it seems to be paying off. Thank you. Yes, one.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that last point is a very good point, because I've looked at those counties that are hit the hardest by losses of federal forest fees, and they tend to be counties that have the lowest tax rates, and yet they have no real opportunity under current law to upgrade those.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Good point. Thank you very much. Thank you for the testimony. Close the public hearing. On, do I have to bang this gavel ever for all of them, or just once? Great. SJR 27, SJR 35, SJR 37, SJR 38, and Senate Bill 921. They're closed. Open a public hearing on a bill that we have heard one time before. Had a lot of great testimony from Stand for Children and other groups on Senate Bill 366. And
Senator Schrader will be making his way from LFO.
So we'll let the sponsor of the bill, Senator Schrader, testify. Matt, you are not Senator Schrader. Today would be a good day to be Senator Schrader, next 2 days. Dana, do you want to come up and join Senator Schrader and bring with you, I want to say, Tom, is it Tom?
He's not testifying today.
He's not testifying.
He's here to support. Would you like me to start? Will we wait for Senator Schrader?
Sure, you guys.
To stop if he gets here.
You have worked on this issue probably more than anyone else in Oregon in the last.
Maybe Tom has
maybe
worked
Tom,
on it more.
Tom also.
Thanks so much for the opportunity to testify today. Chair Deckard, members of the committee. My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the statewide advocacy coordinator with Stand for Children and a former third grade teacher. I was a teacher in Milwaukee, Oregon, not too far from here, and I taught at a school that was built for 476 children. That's the size our cafeteria was made to serve, our stage, our gym, etc. We then, because of the development of a number of apartment complexes near the school, we added 7 portables to increase our capacity to 546 children. Unfortunately, when September rolled around, over 600 kids walked through our doors. So we were significantly above the capacity, even with the added portables. This meant for my kids teaching in a portable, they were, going outside, rain, sleet, snow, et cetera, to go to the bathroom, to wash their hands before lunch, to get water for art or science whenever we did experiments or painting. The music was held on a small stage area that now serves as their counselor's office. And we actually had more than 600 kids and had to send one class of fourth graders and one class of fifth graders to a different school down the street so that they could learn in their portables instead of ours because ours were too overcrowded. Pretty significant transition for those kids who had pretty tough lives to begin with to have to change schools in their fourth and fifth grade years. Stanford Children members are incredibly anxious to see something meaningful for schools move forward. You saw 100 people come to the Beaverton Library, so many that the fire marshal was called in to create a walkway. 25 additional people were scheduled to come down yesterday before... we know the hearing had to be moved, and that's fine, but an additional 25 were scheduled to come yesterday and be a part of the hearing on this bill, and many of them, voters in your districts in particular, I mean, everyone on this committee represents part of a high-growth district, especially in Washington County, Eastern Multnomah County. They're just very anxious to see measures that allow for improvements to their school facilities go through, and they're not going to be ideological or dogmatic about what that looks like. Stanford Children members are not looking for a silver bullet solution. They're not going to dismiss the good in lieu of the perfect. Their criteria are very simple. They want to see legislation move out of this committee and out of this body that will do something meaningful for public school facilities in their communities. And they want something to move out of this committee that has 16 votes in the Senate, 31 votes in the House, and the support of the governor. Senate Bill 366, which we've amended, and I'm not sure if you have -1 amendments in front of you today, but we've amended to make an even more reasonable, moderate proposal. Senate Bill 366, this cap school impact fee, we believe meets these criteria, and members are just incredibly anxious to see it move as quickly as possible. So thank you so much for your time. And I'm going to leave with you just a one-pager from Stanford Children and an editorial from The Oregonian.
Great. Any questions for Ms. Hepper?
Hepper?
Yeah. Both my names are hard.
I think it's a uniquely hard Dana
it
Hepper.
Is.
thank you for all your work on this issue. Seems to be coming to fruition or closer.
Thank you so much.
Kurt, are you?
He's here. Kurt's here.
You're hiding. Come on up. And Suzanne Bonamici, I don't see Suzanne, but you're signed up also. And this is your bill?
Yes, I guess so, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thanks. I'm Senator Kurt Schrader, Senate District 20, and I appreciate the chair and the committee's indulgence in hearing Senate Bill 366. This bill's a long time coming, colleagues. As you may or may not know, having some of the new development in our great state to help pay for the schools and the burden that the development ultimately puts on our school districts has been a passion of mine. It's actually the reason I ran for the state legislature 10 years ago. As a planning commissioner in the little town of Canby, it became apparent that we were growing by leaps and bounds, and the disconnect between we and the planning commission and those in the school board about how they would handle the new students that came in as a result of the growth and development was all too apparent to me. It also was apparent to me as a citizen of that town, which tends to be a little conservative and tries to do what it needs to do and helps one another out, that new taxes were not a real popular idea. And we were building schools. The schools were well supported by my town up until the late 90s. And as the growth and development came on, the citizens started to react against that a little bit and said, well, geez, you know, how come we're doing all this growth? The cost of schools are coming on. Who's paying for that? I did a little research as a planning commissioner and began to find out that, gosh, you know, other states, other items were, their infrastructure items were oftentimes paid for by the developers as they came into the community to help out a little bit. It was kind of a quid pro quo. The developers hopefully do a great job building great homes for our community, people to live. And they hopefully make a nice little profit on that. That's good business. At the same time, there is a burden put on these communities. The home builders working with Lee Oregon Cities and others established system development charges in 1989 that would help communities choose, not mandate, but choose the option of having a fee to help pay for transportation infrastructure, stormwater infrastructure, water infrastructure, sewer, those and parks. And I thought, well, geez, why not schools? Why not schools? It's a critical piece of infrastructure here for the people of our state and certainly our citizens. So that was something I began to check into, and as I said, I ended up running for the state legislature, and I've introduced a bill every session almost, trying to wake people up on this. My freshman session, I got it to the House floor, narrowly defeated because a couple of my colleagues misrepresented what they were going to do for me. Is that pretty tactful? See, I've learned a few things over 10 years. Otherwise,
by misrepresented.
We'll leave that one lying, Mr. Chair, if that's all right. And because it would have passed. It would have passed the House. We have had some interesting and engaging and entertaining conversations with our home builder friends over the last 10 years. Always enjoy working with them. They always have a nice new idea about how to cure this problem of critical infrastructure for our K-12 system. They just never quite get through the assembly, has been my understanding and my sense. And so we've worked closely with them trying to figure out, is there some common ground we could come to? For some reason, I think erroneously, they see this as a huge burden. I see new schools in a subdivision as a huge asset, quite frankly, an attraction for their development and getting people wanting to come to this community because, gosh, it's going to have good schools because I know I'm there and helping to pay for it. So that's a huge attraction. So we agree to disagree on the value of having these impact fees or systems development charges. Well, I'll sum up quickly, Mr. Chair. So we've last interim worked closely with Stanford Children. I worked closely with the home building community, trying to find some common ground on this. The home builders were fairly adamant that they didn't want schools included in a systems development charge ordinance that we currently have. I don't like that. I disagree with that, but I respect their position. So we've switched to an impact fee that you now have before you. There's also concern about rogue jurisdictions establishing an arbitrarily very high fee for school construction. Quite frankly, under this bill, that wouldn't be permitted. It has to be related to their capital development plan. But because of that concern, we've put a cap in our bill on how high a fee a school district could charge should they decide to go down this route. There was concern about affordable housing. You know, we don't want to houses are expensive enough. Geez, what do we need the fee for? And so we put in this affordable housing exemption. So I've tried to address, I think, their major concerns. As the Stand for Children people have alluded to, there are some amendments floating around out there. I'm okay with that. I mean, I'm okay. It's not my way or the highway, but I am adamant that this session, sir, if there's any way possible, this committee should be stepping forward, making a statement about making sure the critical infrastructure for our kids and our schools is in place so that we can take care of a quality education. We can no longer have these classrooms with 30 kids, 35 children in them, and expect them to get a quality education. We're stepping up this session, I think, with a great operational budget for K-12. If I have anything to do about it, as co-chair Ways and Means, but we got to put these kids somewhere. There has to be the building. And this is a fair way to do it. Resonates with every single Oregonian I've talked to of all different political and party stripes. It's just unbelievable. Having new growth help pay its fair share And that's all we're talking about, resonates. This is very simple. It's a great piece of legislation for any legislator. You're lowering future taxes and supporting kids in schools. This should be a win-win for every single person on this committee, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Very good testimony. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, thanks. Senator Schrader, one of the things that I've become increasingly aware of in terms of the capital needs of school districts, and I've spent quite a bit of time as a school board member, is the disparity in taxable value per pupil between districts in this state. I represent the entire David Douglas School District and parts of other school districts, but David Douglas happens to be the second poorest school district in the state in property value per pupil. What that means, and there's a disparity of tenfold or more between one district and another, what that means is that for a district like David Douglas that is growing fast and that has capital needs, that the homeowner that happens to live in that district has to agree to tax him or herself many times more than a homeowner for the same construction living in a wealthy district. And so finding another source of capital money that doesn't rely on this disparate system of value makes a lot of sense to me. And I, too, have talked to the home builders for years about this and with Stanford Children and others, and I agree with you that we need to do something about this problem once and for all.
Thank you.
Senator George, and then we gotta keep moving.
Senator, you said in your statement 11 states currently have these impact fees, school impact fees. Is California one of those?
Yes.
It is. And that, because my understanding is because of illegal immigration in California, that they're facing about a school build a day. And it's an amazing number. And so this is primarily how they're dealing with that illegal immigration, you believe, is
that? That I wouldn't know, Senator George. Okay. That's an interesting question. All I know is that for every house that's built in my little hometown of Canby, we had almost another child historically. And so it's important for the new development to help pick up the tab and take care of our community's health.
Quick follow-up,
please.
Obviously, the developer's not going to pay this fee. It's going to be rolled into the cost of the building. That means a person's going to finance a tax. Does that bother you? Because you and I think very much alike when it comes to not long-term debt to pay short-term costs.
Well, 2 points, if I may, Mr. Chair, Senator George. Number one, it won't be added necessarily to the cost. As you and I know from our high school economics class, the supply and demand actually determine the price of those houses down there. And if the market's good, like it has been historically for last 15 years, well, you know, that home builder, he can make a lot more money regardless of what he put into the building, which is fine. I support the free enterprise system. As a small businessman myself. If the other hand, the market's a little tight, he cannot pass that on necessarily directly to that home buyer. I'll take your side for a moment and say, okay, say it is automatically passed on. It's just a minimis amount of money in the mortgages for affordable housing we have in Oregon. My hometown now, which is shocking to me, affordable housing is $250,000 to $300,000. And a $5,000 to $6,000 impact fee is, again, de minimis in that mortgage. And I think to Senator Monroe's point, if a person's got enough money that they can afford that sort of, quote, affordable, unquote, housing, then I think they could easily afford that fee, and it's much better for them to afford it than have, frankly, some of the people living in my hometown and some of the parks I've got there living on $800 a month, having to have an increased tax bill for the nice new school to take care of these kids. So that's just a fairness issue with me, sir.
In my understanding is California, it is uncapped, and so the new development pays the entire cost of the new school. It's my understanding of California is the most aggressive in terms of the SDC that you would find.
That I don't know the answer to that, Mr. Chair. I think most jurisdictions, there's again, for the committee's benefit, and you already know that it's permissive. This is a tool that a community could choose to elect. That's why we need some sort of statutory guidance so that they have the opportunity to elect this tool. And for systems development charges for lots of other public infrastructure, very few jurisdictions will charge the max. There's quite a range. And I'm just trying to go the extra mile, the giver that I am, to go ahead and cap this thing, because I love, you know, the home builders and rural lives in particular.
Good to good to end on a humorous note.
Yes, sir. Thanks, sir. I've overstayed my welcome, sir.
Great. We need to, Representative Bonamici, we are up against the clock, but please, you have been very active in the Beaverton. I think you were the vice president of the Beaverton Education Foundation.
I was indeed.
And ran some of the bond campaigns.
Senator Deckert. Senator Deckert and members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Bonamici. I'm representing House District 34, which is entirely in Washington County. Here to testify in support of this important bill. My legislative district is entirely in Washington County, and with the exception of a sliver over in the eastern part, it's entirely in the Beaverton School District. And I'm glad to see so many Washington County legislators on this panel, because you know that approximately 1,000 people a month move into Washington County. We're expecting another 500,000 by 2020, and this rapid growth has brought significant challenges, many of which were identified by the good Senator Schrader. I want to say that Beaverton School District is the fastest growing district in the state. There's 37,000 plus students in 47 schools. I am a Beaverton School District parent and have been for the past 13 years. I know we have excellent schools, and I also know that this is a tremendous issue in this district, and I know that our schools are very crowded. We're fortunate in Beaverton to have some magnet programs that relieve some of the overcrowding in the comprehensive schools. My daughter attends the Beaverton Arts and Communication Magnet Academy, which is a great school, but I'll tell you, it's a performing arts school with no performing arts space, no cafeteria. There's this Quonset hut-type building. No lockers. There's no room. A lot of portable classrooms. My daughter has classes in half of a portable. And so this is, although it's relieving the overcrowding in the comprehensive school, high schools, it's not solving any problems. My son graduated from Sunset High School, which is one of the largest high schools in the state. Incredibly crowded. Hallways are packed. His junior year in chemistry class, if everybody showed up, they didn't all have seats. Some of the classes are in these old drafty portable units. Now, we have very high expectations of our students, and we should, but expecting the students and the teachers to do their best in situations like this it just increases their challenges. Now, Washington County, as I explained, there's tremendous growth there, and a lot of people have expressed concerns about how the growth is ahead of the infrastructure. The new developments bring in new families that need additional schools, but they don't provide a way to pay for them. And like Senator Schrader, I've been working on this issue for many years, not as a legislator, but as an advocate for public education. This bill, Senate Bill 366, is one of several solutions that's being considered this session to help pay for capital costs for schools. I am a co-sponsor of House Bill 2525, which allows system development charges, but I'm here to say I support this bill. I'm not wedded to any particular approach. We just need to get this issue addressed. I would, however, prefer an impact fee without a cap. I think that the provisions of Section 2 of this bill provide protection against unreasonable fees because they require the facilities plan, a public hearing, and justification of the need. But as I said in my written testimony, I'm a political realist, and if we need to have a cap in to get this bill through, I will accept that. I have a bit of a concern
President
about...
President Bonamici, I hate to do this. We're going to lose our committee at 10 o'clock.
All right. In summary, I just want to say I have a concern about... lots or parcels that are already created, and that is a concern. This is a significant issue in the district, and all homeowners benefit from good public schools, including increased property values. So please support Senate Bill 366.
Thank you very much. Thank you for I know you've worked hard to build a lot of new schools through sweat equity.
I have.
Questions? Thank you very much. We will try to get something your way in the House dealing with this issue
appreciate that.
As soon as we can.
Thank you.
Okay, home builders, I've passed out LC 3768. John Chandler, Scott, I don't know if you're coming.
Where's that Burl Ives?
There. So I have passed out 3768. It's an LC draft. It is a new idea that I have participated in other, and many others have participated with these two gentlemen. Notice the difference between my description and Senator Schrader's description. And so this bill will be dropped today, and at least it deals with the same very subject. It's in its very initial phase. Thank you, Bob Muir and Legislative Council, for getting us something on paper, which a lot of folks wanted to see. And the home builders, I think, have been working with a coalition of folks to at least get some of this language in place, and welcome you to a committee that you've been wanting to testify before for a long time.
Senator Decker, member of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I am sorry I missed the fun in Beaverton. It sounded like a good time. I've been to school hearings in Beaverton, though, and I've managed to find other reasons to not be there again. Here on behalf of LC Draft 3768, a couple of the bill will be further work, further tests, further hearings, we hope, and work sessions on this item. I want to make it real clear, Senator Schrader, I appreciate his comments. We have worked with the legislature over the years on school issues. In fact, the only thing we have said we don't like is impact fees or SDCs for schools. We believe there is a problem. We believe that especially the fast-growing districts need help getting school buildings built. We've tried over the years with Senator Schrader, with Senator Decker, others, trying to come up with other answers that weren't those. What is in front of you in LC 3768 is a concept of basically taking an existing tax authority at the local level of a construction excise tax or a privilege tax. Senator Monroe is familiar with these, and dedicating it, capping it to school capital construction. There's a blank in the bill for the cap. Mr. Warner's office is working, trying to come up with what the numbers look like statewide, and that the percentage that we'd be charging would depend on what his analysis generates. There's a couple things missing in the bill, Mr. Chairman, if I might mention just for the record, since I know we've talked to people about this, I want to make it very clear. There are three construction excise taxes at the city level currently that we know of, and one at Metro. City of Cornelius, Canby, and Bend have some form of a construction excise tax. It is our intention to grandfather those and not affect them one way or the other by this legislation. The bill, as the LC has drafted, doesn't say that. We've also discussed with our friends in the commercial industrial sector that we'd be very interested and open to a cap of some number with regard to their development. One of the things we like about this concept, better than SDC or an impact fee, is it broadens the base against which school charges are made, not just residential construction, but commercial and industrial as well, up to a number. And we like that not for the obvious reason so much of getting somebody else on the hook with us, because frankly, one of the things that's always made us cranky about the school SDC impact fee issue on residential housing is, unlike water, sewer, and streets, where there is a more direct connection, housing isn't the cause of school children. It's the jobs in the area, the economic vitality of the area, the desirability of the area, all those other things in an area. The more broad you make the payment base, the better we feel, frankly. It gets more people engaged in the conversation, hopefully more money into the kitty for school construction. We think it's going to be a very good bill. It's got a lot of bipartisan support already. We really appreciate your help, Senator Deckard, in getting it put forward, and we look forward to working with the committee. If there's any questions, we'd be happy to try to respond to them.
Thank you. Scott, do you?
Yeah, Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association. The only thing I would, I think I'd like to add to that is one, I think, clear difference and one reason that this excise tax is preferable over an SDC that hasn't been mentioned yet, and that is, frankly, that a lower-income house, let's say a $100,000 house at 1% would pay $1,000. A $500,000 house pays $5,000. So there's a fairness issue here as well, and I think that is an important point that shouldn't be missed. As we like to say, the homes are where jobs go to sleep.
Yeah. I heard that one other time.
And if I might, Senator Decker,
do you have music that plays while you say that?
We usually have full orchestration, but for this purpose, we decided to pass that. Also, just for the record, and as an indication of the seriousness with which we're taking this issue, we are convening an emergency board meeting of our board of directors tomorrow. That may not sound like a big deal, but if all of our directors show up from across Oregon, we have 104 people. So it's a bit of an undertaking to get them all gathered. We're very engaged in this issue. We want to have something come out of this legislature as well, that hopefully something we can live with and not be pummeled with. And we do believe the problem exists. The final thing I want to mention, Mr. Chairman, even though the record is now closed, we are also, if it's of any help to the committee, supportive of doing something about the double majority. We would be, to the extent that home builders' involvement there would be useful, we certainly would be happy to on pretty much any of the options open. And also just one quick report, if I might, on on Senate Bill 336, which you heard earlier, just to report to you, since I know it's of issue on the role of schools in planning. We've been engaging in a work group with school advocates, and we'll hopefully be able to come up with some compromise language there that'll move that issue forward as well. So
great. We're up against the clock. Just wanted to, and we can do a couple of questions. I'm glad, Mr. Chandler, you mentioned the seriousness of this issue, because there's been obviously good cheer in the hearing. But that's the question that came up in testimony, and it's come up to me as I used one of my only two priority bills to at least put this idea into play, and I think it's being dropped with a whole host of others. Is the seriousness of getting something done this session. You heard it in the testimony. We heard it in Beaverton. We certainly heard it this morning, of getting some bill to the governor's desk dealing with school capital. And it's good to hear you put that on the record that y'all are equally and convening your 104, which is a lot, I agree.
It's far too, it's an absurd number, yes. That's a whole different conversation. If we could put something in this legislation to control the size of my board, I'd sure appreciate that, too.
Draft it.
And Senator, I know you're almost out of time. We've kidded around about the distractions, shiny, this is another avenue. In years past, with Senator, particularly Senator Schrader, we have worked very hard on other ideas. They simply didn't work. I don't believe, and I believe Senator Schrader, if he were here, would back me up. That wasn't through any fault of ours. We don't like SDCs. We've made that clear, and we're hoping we can find an answer that isn't an SDC or an impact fee, and we are committed to doing that.
Thank you. Here's what we will do on this. I know there's a lot of folks that are interested, from the real estate industry to the general contractors to school advocates that are here. This will lose its LC form and take an SB form, which makes it obviously more real, and then we'll just repost it with 366 and keep those ideas together and repost it as soon as we can as our schedule. But we'll make it a priority to get it back up and have a full public hearing and probably allow that to be the only two bills on the docket here probably in a week or so.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You guys have worked really hard to get this to its point.
I just wanted to thank them. I have a long history working with the home builders on construction excise taxes and would like to suggest that you need to be talking to Stanford Children.
We have been, Senator.
Okay, yep. Very good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we're trying to keep Dana and Stan as integral players.
Yes.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 366. We are adjourned.